internet at VOA1 The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo and Brian Lynn. Dan Novak presents this week's Education Report, and John Russell brings us the Lesson of the Day. But first, here is Anna Mateo reading a winning entry from our Teach Us About Ukraine writing contest.
As the Pshemyshl Kiev train arrives for women and children, men with tears in their eyes wait on the platform with flowers. In the waiting room, a soldier says goodbye to his daughter, who does not want to let go. For 153 years, the train station in Kyiv has witnessed many emotional gatherings and partings. Since the start of the Russian invasion on February 24, 2022, it is hard to imagine how many people have departed and how many will return in the future. At the Universitet metro station, beautiful marble walls serve as a background for the white busts of famous Ukrainians. They include the scientist Alexander Bohomolets and writers like Ivan Franko, Taras Shevchenko, and Hirihori Skovorida. The busts of the Russians have been removed. There will never be a place for them here again. As you come out of the station, there is the O.V. Fomin Botanical Garden, one of the oldest botanical gardens in Ukraine. Founded in 1839, it has 22.5 hectares of plants from temperate and subtropical areas. It includes several 200-year-old trees that have survived from the time before the founding of the garden itself. Next to the garden is the red building of Taras Shevchenko Kyiv National University. The university calls itself a leading research and education center in Ukraine. Before the war, more than 26,000 students attended nearly 30 schools and centers at the university. Across the street is St. Volodymyr Cathedral. Built in the 19th century, the cathedral included the works of many well-known artists, including Mykola Pimenenko and Viktor Samuralyo. As the Bolsheviks came to power, Soviet Union officials banned services and took away sacred items. At first, the cathedral was turned into a museum of atheism, and then a library for a teacher's training college. After the declaration of Ukraine's independence, it became a religious center for the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. The best-known religious center in Kyiv is St. Sophia Cathedral. The cathedral complex, named a UNESCO World Heritage Site, has been in the city's historic center for 1,000 years. It is one of the most visited landmarks in Kyiv, and it houses the largest collection of 11th century mosaics and frescoes. Nearby is St. Andrew's Church, an example of 18th century Baroque architecture. Behind the church is the Alley of Artists, where visitors can walk alongside hundreds of paintings and street performances. This is where the thirst for life is soaring. A monument to Volodymyr the Great is hidden under sandbags for safety. But hopefully, one day, it will stand again in its glory. A few city blocks away is Kyiv City Teachers Building, home of the historic Central Rada. Central Rada, or Council, brought together political and cultural organizations in Kyiv that started the national movement. In 1918, the Central Rada adopted the Fourth Universal, declaring Ukrainian independence during the height of the Ukraine-Soviet War from 1917 to 1921. In the battle near Kruty in 1918, about 500 Ukrainian military cadets and students defended Kyiv against nearly 5,000 Bolshevik soldiers, foreshadowing the current Ukrainian fight against Russian invasion. At the National Opera House of Ukraine, once again, there are performances of Giselle, and performances of The Witch of Konotop are sold out at Ivan Franko National Academic Drama Theater. Finally, one arrives at Independence Square. The square is the heart of Ukraine. It is the place where Ukrainian statehood and self-determination started with the Maidan Revolution. It is the place to remember the Heavenly Hundred, who died for freedom. It is a symbol of Ukraine's struggle and victory, pain and rebirth, and strength and endurance. Recently, 12-year-old Yaroslav played violin at the square. Next to him was a sign for buying a drone for the armed forces. And 10-year-old Sophia sold blue and yellow bracelets. She said the money was for repairing her brother's car. Her brother, who is fighting at war. I'm Anna Mateo.
A U.S.-based developer of a brain-computer implant is reportedly preparing to carry out major testing of its device on humans. The company is called Synchron. The Reuters news agency reported that Synchron recently launched an online system that permits patients to express interest in taking part in a large research study or trial. The company has also been in contact with more than 100 research centers that want to support the study, Synchron chief executive Thomas Oxley told Reuters. Synchron's device is known as a brain-computer interface. It is designed to treat individuals who experience paralysis caused by injury or disease. The device contains a small computer built to electronically communicate with the brain. The first tests aim to use the brain-computer interface to process brain signals to help paralyzed patients type on a computer. Synchron's interface is similar to a device currently being tested by its American competitor, Neuralink. One difference is that Neuralink's device is designed to be implanted inside the skull. Synchron's device uses a less invasive implant method known as endovascular. The company says this involves a vein carrying the device into a part of the brain known as the motor cortex. This part of the brain produces signals to direct body movements. Synchron is farther along in the development of its implant than Neuralink, Reuters reports. Neuralink's progress has mainly been announced by company chief Elon Musk on the X social media service that he owns. So far, Neuralink has said its device has been implanted in one paralyzed patient. Testing implants in patients with brain damage can be difficult. This is because an individual's brain may be so severely damaged that there is not effective signaling to record. Synchron's Oxley said the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, asked his company to test stroke patients using a non-invasive method to see if they would be good implant candidates. In 2020, Synchron said experiments involving paralyzed patients in Australia found the individuals could use its device to type letters into a computer at a higher rate than in earlier studies. Synchron received U.S. approval in July 2021 to carry out early testing. It has implanted its devices in 6 patients so far. Tests involving 4 patients in Australia showed no serious side effects, the company has reported. Synchron says it will be examining data from its current testing to prepare for the larger study. The company must still receive FDA approval to move forward with the new study. Several U.S. hospitals have cooperated with Synchron on its current testing program. These include Mount Sinai in New York, the University of Buffalo Neurosurgery, and the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, UPMC. The company has said it hopes to involve these same medical centers in the larger trial. Dr. David Lakamas is chief of UPMC's neuromuscular division. He told Reuters his team is still involved in the current testing program and said the study is going well. I'm Brian Lynn.
An illustrated edition of Margaret Atwood's book, The Handmaid's Tale, was released in 2019. The book is widely considered a classic work about the oppression of women. An illustrated version of the book would help it reach teens who struggle with words alone. Educators in Clayton, Missouri, needed little debate before deciding to keep copies of the book in high school libraries. But Missouri legislators passed a law in 2022 punishing librarians with fines and possible imprisonment for permitting sexually explicit materials on bookshelves. The school system reconsidered the new Atwood edition and later removed it from libraries. Across the country, book bans and attempted book bans are becoming more common. Public and school-based libraries have seen a rise in complaints from community members and conservative activists. Now, some lawmakers are considering adding new threats, legal action, high fines, and even imprisonment for distributing books that some consider to be obscene or inappropriate. Obscene means related to sex in an offensive way. No librarian or educator has been jailed yet, but the possibility of punishment has led to more self-censorship. Already this year, lawmakers in more than 15 states have introduced bills to place severe penalties on libraries or librarians. Utah passed legislation in March that empowers the state's attorney general to enforce a new system that can remove sensitive books from schools. In Idaho, lawmakers are considering a bill that empowers local prosecutors to bring legal action against public and school libraries if they do not keep harmful materials away from children. Deborah Caldwell Stone is director of the American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom. She said the laws are designed to limit or remove legal protections that libraries have had for decades. Since the early 1960s, places like schools, libraries, and museums have largely been safe from costly lawsuits or criminal charges. Educators, librarians, and other workers who give out materials to children have also been safe. These protections began appearing in states as American lawmakers and others debated standards surrounding obscenity. The term was defined by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1973. The High Court justices found that the First Amendment does not automatically protect obscene materials. For something to be obscene, it must meet three requirements. One requirement is that the work must lack serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value. Over time, almost every American state created protections for educators, librarians, and museum officials. This prevented prosecutions of teachers over health and sexuality curriculum, art, theater, and difficult subjects in English classes, says a 2023 report from Every Library. The group, a National Political Action Committee, opposes censorship. But last year, Arkansas and Indiana targeted educators and librarians with criminalization laws. And the state of Tennessee criminalized publishers that provide obscene materials to public schools. Indiana lawmakers took away educational purposes as a defense for school librarians and educators charged with giving minors obscene or harmful material. Doing so are crimes punishable by up to 2.5 years in jail and $10,000 in fines. The law requires public lists of what is in each school library. It also requires libraries to set up a system to respond to complaints about the available materials. Indiana's law took effect January 1st. Diane Rogers is a school librarian who serves as president of the Indiana Library Federation. She said of the new law, "It's putting fear into some people. It's very scary." She added that teachers who face charges because of the new law could lose their right to teach, even if they are found innocent. I'm Dan Novak.
Dan Novak joins me now to talk more about the education report. Hi, Dan. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Yesterday, we spoke a bit about obscenity and who gets to define what is obscene. First of all, what is the exact dictionary definition of obscenity?
Something obscene is something offensive or disgusting or beyond the accepted standards of morality. It's often related to sex, but not always.
We learned in your story that the U.S. Supreme Court defined obscenity as it relates to the First Amendment to the Constitution. What more can you tell us about the legal definition of obscenity?
So, the First Amendment protects the freedom of speech. But that freedom is not absolute, or not without some exceptions, one being obscene materials. In the 1973 case, Miller v. California, the court established three requirements for something to be obscene. One, the work, if taken as a whole, must appeal to sexual interests. Two, the work must depict or describe sexual conduct in a, quote, patently offensive way. And three, the work must lack serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value. Something is considered obscene only if all three conditions are met.
It does not seem like the books being banned from schools fit those three requirements.
Yeah, you're right. Works of fiction certainly have artistic value, for example. But banning books from schools is easier legally than banning books from the public overall because of those First Amendment protections. School districts and states have the ability to censor certain books that they consider harmful, even if they do not fit the Supreme Court's definition of obscenity. However, I do expect there to be legal challenges to the laws described in the story that go after librarians and educators for distributing these banned materials.
Well, thanks for answering my questions, Dan, and thanks again for that report.
You're welcome, Ashley.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
In this next report, Dan Friedel tells us about an app released by U.S. Customs and Border Protection. The app aims to improve the entry process into the United States. Pay careful attention to the use of one verb, complain. We will talk more about it after the report.
Pete de Sterk of Belgium, his wife and their two sons, worried about how long it would take to get through passport control at Dulles Airport in Virginia. They were just beginning their fourth visit to the United States. It was always a long row, he said, about the wait they experienced on earlier visits. But this time, the de Sterks had downloaded a new app to their phones. The app was designed to make the entry process faster. It worked. The family passed through passport control quickly. With the app, it's amazing, Pete de Sterk said. U.S. Customs and Border Protection, CBP, released the app called Mobile Passport Control to improve the entry process. In the past, many solo travelers to the U.S. came for business events, so they could move through quickly. However, families with children were not so lucky. But things are changing. Families are a growing group of travelers, and video meetings have reduced the need for business travel. CBP officials recently gave reporters a look at the new technology. In 2023, the agency processed over 394 million travelers coming into the U.S., an increase of 24% over 2022. At the same time, waiting time is going down at most airports. For airports that are very busy, the wait time is up a small amount, but customs officers are seeing 30% more passports than before. The app is available for Americans, permanent U.S. residents, Canadians, and travelers from other countries that have agreements with the U.S. Travelers upload their information and photos to the app. People who have the app go to a separate line for processing. An officer then will take a picture of one member of the family. A computer recognizes the image and provides all the necessary information to process the whole group. CBP launched the app in 2021, but is now trying to get more people to use it. About 4.1 million people did so last year. The CBP said it is working with airlines to help people download the app while on their way to the U.S. Mark Calixte is the top CBP official at Dulles Airport. He said, "Any second helps to save time. It adds up eventually," he said. There is another app for people who use Global Entry, a CBP program, to ease entry for travelers it considers low risk. The next step for CBP may be to make an internal change that will help passengers register for Global Entry. About 3.2 million people sought to join last year, but it is a long wait for the required interview with the agency. The agency says it takes as long as 6 months to process requests. This year, CBP will offer about 4 million interviews. Earlier this year, American lawmakers wrote the agency to ask about the slowness of the process. They noted that the citizens they represent had been complaining about it. Brendan Blackmer is a chief for CBP's programs that include Global Entry. He said the agency is working to make more appointments available, to hold interviews at airports, and to make it easier for those who already have Global Entry to renew their membership. Some travelers will face increased costs connected to the programs for easing the entry process. Global Entry, for example, will rise by $20. Other tech changes are ahead. Calixte said e-gates will be added to some airports. That will permit those with Global Entry to move through the airport without meeting with the border agent. Down the road, Blackmer said, the app will permit the agency to sort travelers into groups ahead of time. For example, if they say they do not have anything to show an agent, they will be placed into a line that would move faster. I'm Dan Friedel.
Before the report, we asked you to pay careful attention to one verb, complain. Can you remember when you heard it? You heard the verb used to describe an action that citizens had been taking in the past. Let's listen again.
This year, CBP will offer about 4 million interviews. Earlier this year, American lawmakers wrote the agency to ask about the slowness of the process. They noted that the citizens they represent had been complaining about it.
Complain means to speak or write about a problem or a perceived problem. We spell complain like this. C-O-M-P-L-A-I-N. In our example, we heard a form of the verb called the past perfect progressive, or past perfect continuous. Had been complaining suggests the action was ongoing in the past, up to a certain point in time. So, we can learn from the verb form that American lawmakers received ongoing complaints from citizens they represent, at least up until the point in time in which the lawmakers wrote the letter or note. The complaints could have continued after that point in time as well, but we do not know for sure. The past perfect progressive can be difficult because it involves mixing a main verb with helping or auxiliary verbs. That said, if you pay careful attention to how it is used in news stories, books, or even in films, you can learn how to use it well. And that's the lesson of the day. I'm John Russell.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley.